Peter Johnson introducing a Catholic Heritage program broadcasting from England, bringing you traditions, trips, and stories from our Catholic past and inspiration for our Catholic future. In this program, we hear about one of the greatest of our English martyrs, Edmund Campion. It's a story that takes us back to the 16th century and the time of Queen Elizabeth I. It's a story of religious tension, intrigue, royal politics, and deep, courageous faith. Joanna Bogle takes up the story.
The Thames Valley is one of the prettiest parts of England. Henley, on the banks of the Thames, is famous for its regatta, held every summer since the 1880s. But I came to its small railway station this summer for another purpose, bringing a band of pilgrims to visit Stoner, a country house famous for its links with St. Edmund Campion. Stoner is the family name of Lord Camoys, whose family have lived in this house and owned this land for generations. Most significantly, they've remained Catholic. They're one of the most famous of England's recusant families, who held to the Catholic faith during the years of persecution that began after King Henry VIII had broken with Rome and the Church of England was formally established in the 16th century. Stoner today still has a Catholic chapel where Mass is regularly celebrated. The house, which is open to the public and boasts beautiful grounds and a tea room and so on, contains an attic, which most Catholic visitors regard as the most important place of all. Here, under these rafters, St. Edmund Campion had his secret printing press, on which he printed his famous brag and announced the plan to reconvert all of England to the Catholic faith. Who was St. Edmund Campion? Unlike Saints John Fisher and Thomas More, he's not a household name among English-speaking Catholics, but he ought to be. In many ways, he was braver than either Fisher or More, enduring appalling physical torture to which neither of them were actually subjected, and dying by the barbaric method of hanging, drawing, and quartering. But the first records that we have of him are not linked to darkness, torture, or imprisonment at all, quite the contrary. In the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, in 1566, on a bright September day, he played a glittering part in one of the great events of her reign, the Queen's visit to Oxford. Such a visit was not a one-day event, a quick arrival by car or train and the presentation of a posy and unveiling of a plaque, like a modern royal visit to a town. 400 years ago, a royal visit was on a very different scale. The journey to Oxford took several days and involved a magnificent royal progress with a procession of attendants, jingling horses and cheering crowds. The Queen was known for her learning, and she was visiting one of her country's two great universities. But her religious position was anomalous. For centuries, the monarch had symbolized the nation's link with the Catholic Church. Crowned and anointed in a solemn ceremony, married with the rites of the Church, bringing the next heir to the font for baptism, a monarch carried out public duties wholly under the Church's mantle and with her blessing. What then did people think of this new reign, this monarch with a state church of her own, and who was herself the fruit of a union not validated by the Catholic Church, since her mother was Anne Boleyn, whom the king had married adulterously after sending away his first and true wife, Catherine of Aragon? The people of England were confused. Pageantry and music, might and splendour were to be used to ram home the message that Elizabeth was the true queen and that obedience to her was necessary. At Oxford, everything was brought into play for her honour, and one of the many events performed before her was a speech by the 26-year-old brilliant scholar Edmund Campion, fellow of St. John's College, who spoke in Latin. He was a minister of the new Church of England, a deacon awaiting full ordination. Oxford had always produced clergymen and was now doing so exclusively for this new state church. Many of its colleges, including Edmund Campion's own, were broadly Catholic in sympathy. But did the witty, good-looking Campion at this stage have religious doubts? Like others in the university, he recognized the significance of the Queen's visit and concentrated on the matter in hand. But Campion was not a superficial person. While he could make a speech before a queen which masked his own deepest wonderings, his mind was applying itself profoundly to the things that really mattered. Deep in his soul, a debate was going on. His was not a mind that could be satisfied with a political solution to a religious matter. Deeply and prayerfully, he studied the realities of the Christian faith, its unbroken tradition and its unchanging doctrines. There could be no church that was not founded by Christ, no faith except that owned by the fathers. All around him, others were similarly studying, talking, often secretly, sometimes rather more openly, and searching. Were there seven sacraments? How then the sudden decision that there were only two? What was the Mass? What office does a bishop hold, and why? Does heresy matter? Campion became a Catholic. He left Oxford and, finally, England. Eventually, he found his way to France, to the English exile community at Douai, to the college there where priests were being trained for the English mission. And after his conversion, perhaps the most important journey of all, he joined the Jesuit order and was ordained a priest in the Company of Jesus, the religious order founded by St. Ignatius. He was sent to work in Prague and elsewhere and found himself visiting some of the most fascinating parts of Europe. He was to write and study. He created plays that would be enjoyed by princes and emperors. He became fluent in several languages. But eventually, on the orders of his superiors, he undertook the great mission of his life. He was sent back to England to revive the Catholic faith there, to bring back the confused, and to bond once again the people of his own island to the universal church. Elizabeth's power was stronger now. Her police system was efficient. Ships were searched for spies, and especially for Catholic priests who might upset her plans for a serene and unhurried move towards a universal state church. She'd had no active plans for persecution initially. The old Catholic priests would die out, and with them would die the old ideas. Her new church ministers were not, so far, a very impressive band of men, but with control over the universities, new appointments would be made as new men came forward and were ordained and organized. Meanwhile, she was honored as Gloriana, and people gave to her the honor that people longed to give a monarch, and were encouraged to think of her in almost religious terms, naming her a virgin queen. Could a few men, unarmed, and knowing the pitiless horror that awaited them if persecution really began in earnest, truly reclaim this land for Christ's church? Once their plans became known, Elizabeth's passive ideas about Catholicism ceased. If the faith was not to die out, it must be stamped out. Henceforth, cruel penal laws, the rack, the dungeon, the executioner's rope, and the taunts of torturers would be used. It was this reality which Campion recognized when, undaunted, he announced his return to his native land.
To the Right Honourable the Lords of Her Majesty's Privy Council. Whereas I have come out of Germany and Bohemia, being sent by my superiors, and adventured myself unto this noble realm, my dear country, for the glory of God and benefit of souls, I thought it like enough that in this busy, watchful, and suspicious world, I should either sooner or later be intercepted and stopped of my course. Wherefore, providing for all events, and uncertain what may become of me, when God shall haply deliver my body into durance, I supposed it needful to put this writing in a readiness, desiring your good lordships to give it your reading, for to know my cause. This doing, I trust I shall ease you of some labour, for that which otherwise you must have sought for by practice of wit, I do now lay into your hands by plain confession. And to the intent that the whole matter may be conceived in order, and so the better both understood and remembered, I make thereof these 9 points or articles, directly, truly, and resolutely, opening my full enterprise and purpose. I confess that I am, albeit unworthy, a priest of the Catholic Church, and through the great mercy of God, vowed now these 8 years into the religion of the Society of Jesus. Hereby I have taken upon me a special kind of warfare, under the banner of obedience, and eke resigned all my interest or possibility of wealth, honour, pleasure, and other worldly felicity. At the voice of our general provost, which is to me a warrant from heaven and oracle of Christ, I took my voyage from Prague to Rome, where our said general father is always resident, and from Rome to England, as I might and would have done, joyously, into any part of Christendom or heathenness, had I been thereto assigned. My charge is, of free cost, to preach the gospel, to minister the sacraments, to instruct the simple, to reform sinners, to confute errors, in brief, to cry alarm spiritual against foul vice and proud ignorance, wherewith many, my dear countrymen, are abused. I never had mind, and am strictly forbidden, by our Father that sent me, to deal in any respect with matter of state or policy of this realm, as things which appertain not to my vocation, and from which I do gladly restrain and sequester my thoughts. I do ask, to the glory of God, with all humility and under your correction, 3 sorts of indifferent and quiet audiences. The first, before your honours, wherein I will discourse of religion, so far as it toucheth the common weal and your nobilities. The second, whereof I make more account, before the doctors and masters and chosen men of both universities, wherein I undertake to avow the faith of our Catholic Church, by proofs innumerable, scriptures, councils, fathers, history, natural and moral reasons. The third, before the lawyers, spiritual and temporal, wherein I will justify the said faith, by the common wisdom of the laws standing yet in force and practice. I would be loath to speak anything that might sound of any insolent brag or challenge, especially being now as a dead man to this world, and willing to put my head under every man's foot, and to kiss the ground they tread upon. Yet have I such a courage in avouching the majesty of Jesus my King, and to such affiance in his gracious favour, and such assurance in my quarrel, and my evidence so impregnable, and because I know perfectly that no one Protestant, nor all the Protestants living, nor any sect of our adversaries, howsoever they face men down in pulpits, and overrule us in their kingdom of grammarians and unlearned ears, can maintain their doctrine in disputation. I am to sue most humbly and instantly for the combat with all and every of them, and the most principal that may be found, protesting that in this trial, the better furnished they come, the better welcome they shall be. Because it hath pleased God to enrich the Queen, my sovereign lady, with notable gifts of nature, learning, and princely education, I do verily trust that, if Her Highness would vouchsafe her royal person and good attention to such a conference as in the second part of my 5th article I have motioned, or to a few sermons which in her or your hearing I am to utter, such manifest and fair light by good method and plain dealing may be cast upon these controversies, that possibly her zeal of truth and love of her people shall incline her noble grace to disfavour some proceedings hurtful to the realm, and procure towards us, oppressed, more equity. Moreover, I doubt not but you, Her Highness Council, being of such wisdom and discreet in cases most important, when you shall have heard these questions of religion opened faithfully, which many times by our adversaries are huddled up and confounded, will see upon what substantial grounds our Catholic faith is builded, how feeble that side is which, by sway of the time, prevaileth against us. And so, at last, for your own souls, and for many thousand souls that depend upon your government, will discountenance error when it is bewrayed, and hearken to those who would spend the best blood in their bodies for your salvation. Many innocent hands are lifted up to heaven for you daily, by those English students, whose posterity shall never die, which, beyond seas, gathering virtue and sufficient knowledge for the purpose, are determined never to give you over, but either to win you heaven or to die upon your pikes. And touching our society, be it known to you that we have made a league, all the Jesuits in the world, whose succession and multitude must overreach all the practices of England, cheerfully to carry the cross you shall lay upon us, and never to despair your recovery while we have a man left to enjoy your Tyburn, or to be racked with your torments, or consumed with your prisons. The expense is reckoned. The enterprise is begun. It is of God. It cannot be withstood. So the faith was planted. So it must be restored. If these my offers be refused, and my endeavors can take no place, and I, having run thousands of miles to do you good, shall be rewarded with rigor, I have no more to say but to recommend your case and mine to Almighty God, the Searcher of Hearts, who send us his grace and set us at accord before the day of payment, to the end we may at last be friends in heaven, when all injuries shall be forgotten.
Campion crossed to England and began his ministry there, travelling from place to place, disguised as a private gentleman, accompanied by somebody who was his servant, both of them priests, both of them ministering to the small communities of Catholics. It was all to end at Tyburn on the Tyburn gallows. I'm speaking just where Tyburn once stood, and where traffic now roars along the Bayswater Road. A convent stands near the site. Campion had many months of freedom before he was arrested and taken to Tyburn gallows. Catholic writer Evelyn Waugh, in his classic Life of Campion, published in the 1950s, describes the masses that would have been celebrated by Campion in country houses, where he travelled in disguise from place to place. Evelyn Waugh writes, "Word would go round the countryside that Campion had arrived, and throughout the evening, Catholics of every degree, squire, labourer, and deposed cleric, would stealthily assemble. He would sit up half the night receiving each in turn, hearing their confessions and resolving their difficulties. Then before dawn, a room would be prepared for mass. Watches were set in case of alarm. The congregation knelt on the rush-strewn floor. Mass was said. Communion was given. Then Campion would preach. It needs little fancy to reconstruct the scene. The audience hushed and intent, every member of whom was risking liberty and fortune, perhaps his life, by attendance. The dusk lightened, and the candles paled on the improvised altar. The treetops outside the window took fire as Campion spoke. The thrilling tones, the profusion of imagery, the polish and precision, the balanced, pointed argument, the whole structure and rich ornament of rhetoric which had stirred the lecture halls and collegiate chapels of Oxford and Dowie, Rome, Prague and Reims, inspired now with more than human artistry, rang through the summer dawn. And when the discourse had mounted to its peroration and the fiery voice had dropped to the quiet traditional words of the blessing, a long silence while the priest disrobed and assumed once more his secular disguise, a hurried packing away of the altar furniture, a few words of leave-taking, and then the horse's hooves clattered once more in the cobbled yard. Campion was on his way, and the Catholics dispersed to their homes." Campion visited many houses in this way, both Catholic and non-Catholic. Sometimes the house of a non-Catholic would include many Catholic servants, friends, or other visitors. Campion could mingle with them. As a traveller, he would be given shelter, and a secret room somewhere cut off from the rest of the house would be chosen where Mass could be celebrated and confessions heard. He also went to London for urgent secret meetings with Father Parsons and with others. When two Jesuits met, they could hear each other's confessions, exhort each other, pass on news and information, encourage each other, and then secretly go on their way. Evelyn Waugh mentions priests who'd been deposed. These were the old Catholic priests who'd been turned out of their presbyteries and vicarages to make way for the new clergy. Many were trying to minister to their flocks, but they too were confused and were often presented by penitents in confession because of the complexities that arose. For example, whether or not it was possible to attend a wedding in a Protestant church, or whether it was sinful to do so. Campion, fresh from Rome with news, information and the latest canon law, was able to explain to Catholics just how important it was to hold fast to the Catholic faith. Everywhere he inspired hope and courage. Mother John Baptist is Secretary General of the Tyburn Nuns, who are here on the site of Tyburn Gallows. Now, how long have you been here on the site of Tyburn Gallows, Mother?
Well, we're not actually on the site of the gallows. We're 300 paces from the site, but we are on Tyburn Field, which was a very big field, 170 acres.
And so people would have stood here and watched Edmund Campion and the other martyrs meet their deaths.
Yes. They stood around. They made it a holiday. Some people in the crowd must have been Catholics. And I think they would have been very sad. But when they thought about it later, they would have been very happy and proud.
And you've got a replica of the gallows, haven't you, in your little crypt chapel and mementos of the martyrs?
Yes, we have a very small replica of the Tyburn tree with three uprights and three crossbeams. The real Tyburn tree was horrifyingly big. It was meant to terrify people, and it did.
And then round the upper chapel, you've got, is it the coats of arms of the martyrs?
Yes, some of the families of the martyrs had coats of arms, and they are there. And some of them belong to religious bodies, and their emblems are there. And many of them studied at Oxford and Cambridge, and their emblems are there.
And do you get a lot of visitors?
Oh, yes, we get them from all over the world. Americans are particularly enthusiastic about the English martyrs. Mm. But we get them from South America, from Australia and New Zealand, but from everywhere, really.
You yourself, your accent betrays you. You're not English, are you?
No, I come from Australia. We have a monastery in Australia and I entered there, but I came to Tyburn 23 years ago.
Campion had been tried and found guilty at Westminster after being arrested at Lyford Grange, the place where he was last being able to say Mass. In fact, he'd been hidden, and the people who came to hunt for him had gone away from the house thinking they hadn't found anybody, but were persuaded by one of their number to turn back, and they finally tracked Campion down. Campion's trial had been at Westminster Great Hall, where, a generation earlier, St. Thomas More had also been tried. When the time came for him to raise his right hand to acknowledge the verdict, Campion found he was unable to do so, because he had been so cruelly tortured on the rack. Another martyr, who was facing death with him, Ralph Sherwin, now Saint Ralph Sherwin, gently took his hand and kissed it and raised it aloft with his own. When the judge came to sign his name against the verdict, he found he was unable to do so, because his right hand was covered in blood, although there was no mark of any wound. Campion was finally given the opportunity to speak. "It was not our death that ever we feared," he said, "but we knew that we were not lords of our own lives, and therefore, for want of answer, would not be guilty of our deaths. The only thing that we now have to say is that if our religion do make us traitors, we are worthy to be condemned, but otherwise are, and have been, as good subjects as ever the Queen had. In condemning us, you condemn all your own ancestors. all the ancient bishops, priests and kings, all that was once the glory of England, the island of saints, and the most devoted child of the See of Peter. For what have we taught, however you may qualify it with the odious name of treason, that they did not uniformly teach? To be condemned with these lights, not of England only, but of the world, by their degenerate descendants, is both gladness and glory to us. God lives, posterity will live. Their judgment is not so liable to corruption as those who are now going to sentence us to death. Sentence was duly passed, and Edmund Campion was hung, drawn, and quartered in a barbaric manner at Tyburn. Campion was canonized in 1970 by Pope Paul VI as one of the 40 martyrs of England and Wales. His life and witness remain an inspiration not only to Catholics in England, but across the world. The expense is reckoned, the enterprise is begun. It is of God, it cannot be withstood.
We hope that you've enjoyed this look at some of our Catholic heritage. There'll be more next time, so we hope you'll join us then. If you have any comments or snippets of history or information, do write to me, Peter Johnson, at Catholic Heritage, EWTN Global Catholic Radio, 1500 High Road, Vandiver, that's Vandiver, Alabama, USA, 35176. Or you can email us at radio@ewtn.com.